So, hello everybody. Good morning. Welcome along to this short course based around one of the Gathas. This is the Navajra Kata Sutra. So, my name is Eddie, of course. You probably all know me already. So, we'll begin as we normally do by doing a short meditation together, whereby we'll have a visualization and we'll set the motivation and then take refuge and generate a mind of enlightenment together. So please make yourselves comfortable in your seat. Essentially, this means that your back is straight. Place your hands wherever you like and just relax your shoulders. Now, if you like, you can keep your eyes as they are, or you could close them. And as you continue to breathe, normally and naturally, become aware of the movements that take place in your body. And these movements are often felt either at the abdomen or in the upper chest. So each time you inhale or exhale, movement will take place. And I'd like you just to become aware of that. Just place your attention wherever the movement takes place. If you find yourself thinking about the past, present, or the future, just let those thoughts go for the moment. And you can do that by just relaxing a little more and placing your attention on the body so that you become aware of the movements that take place whenever you inhale or exhale. While you continue to breathe normally and naturally, imagine that your spiritual lineage appears in the room you're sitting in above your head. And this lineage, this family of yours, the spiritual family, contains all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and every other enlightened being. And they are above your head, in your room with you. And while they're present, imagine that every other sentient being includes your parents, uncles and aunts, children, other family members, and friends and enemies and strangers. Think that they're all sitting surrounding you. And all of these people, all of these beings are the same as we are, in that they have a wish to be happy and they wish to avoid suffering. The two wishes can be accomplished if they and we could rely upon the spiritual lineage surrounding us. So in the center of this vast family of enlightened beings, there is the figure of Shakyamuni Buddha. And so he taught the four noble truths, that there is suffering, it has causes, there is a way to bring an end to that suffering, and there is the end of that suffering. A sense of freedom and liberation. So think that you're going to rely upon the Buddha and his lineage. To accomplish your own welfare and to bring about the welfare of all sentient beings. So you make an aspiration, a wish to become enlightened for the benefit of all beings. And in response to that aspiration, the field of enlightened beings begin to dissolve into light, which melts into the central figure of Shakyamuni Buddha. An emanation of him leaves his heart and moves through space to abide above the crown of your head. Melts into light, melting through your skull, traveling down, and stops at the level of your heart. Then light begins to spread out and fill your body and mind. The light goes out further, moving out through the pores of your skin and filling the 10 directions of space. And wherever there are living beings within space, they are touched by that light and transformed to be fully awakened beings. And from the heart center of each of those beings, light rays go out to the 10 directions of space again. I think there is no difference between yourself and any other enlightened being. In fact, there's no sense of self and other, inside and outside, here or there. These artificial boundaries have all dissolved. And you rest in your own nature. Which is the empty nature of all phenomena. Now the light begins to withdraw from the 10 directions of space, re-entering your body at the level of the heart. And as you breathe normally and naturally, you can feel yourself embodied and sitting on your seat. And you affirm once again that we must become enlightened to accomplish the welfare we have always sought for ourselves and then help others do the same. And now breathing in deeply through your nostrils. Exhale through your mouth. You can gently let your eyes flutter open and bring your awareness back to the room you're sitting in. Now we'll take refuge together and generate the mind of enlightenment. We'll recite the four immeasurables, the seven limb prayer, and we'll make a mandala offering. So taking refuge and generating bodhicitta. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. As a means to stabilize and enhance that wish, we'll recite the four immeasurables. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Now, enlightenment depends upon the abandonment of everything that hinders enlightenment, and the accumulation of all the causes and conditions that bring about enlightenment. All these practices are included with a prayer called the Seven Limbs. So we'll recite that now. Reverently I prostrate with my body, speech and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate barren merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. So now we make an offering to the Buddhas and so forth. Short mandala. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this is a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Yidam Guru Ratna Mandalakam Niryata Yadami. So I think that the mandala offering has been accepted by the Buddha and the entourage. And smiles of delight are extended towards us. We should think now that we are ready to listen to the teachings, absorb as much of it as we can, and put it into practice the best way we can. So, okay, everyone, thank you. That's the preliminaries. Let's have a look now at the course I've prepared. So, what we'll be doing is we have this sutra called the Vajrakatha. It's made up of what they call 32 sort of gathas, or 32 parts. And we're just going to look at one of those parts. It's in the 32nd. And this is this verse that some of you might be quite familiar with. Now, the Sanskrit title for the sutra is called the Vajra Chetaka Prajna Paramita, which is translated roughly as Vajrakatha, a perfection of wisdom, or sometimes Diamond Cutter Sutra. So these sort of shortened versions are quite common. Now the title relies on this word Vajra, which can refer to two things. One is like a thunderbolt or a diamond. And it's sort of like a metaphor for power, strength, and ability to cut. And this is all sort of referring to a type of wisdom that cuts and shatters the illusions of conventional truth, bringing us to the ultimate reality of things, their emptiness. Now, this sutra, Vajrakata Sutra, is sometimes also called the 300 lines of Perfection Sutra. So those of you who have read it, you'll know that it's made up basically of a discourse between the Buddha and one of his senior disciples, in fact, the wisest of his disciples, called Subhuti. And in the sutra, Subhuti asks the Buddha various questions about selflessness, emptiness, the role of the bodhisattva, what generosity is, and so forth. And then the Buddha responds, and sometimes the Buddha will ask Subhuti different types of questions too. Now, this sutra is a very, very old sutra. In fact, it's the oldest, one of the very oldest books that we have. And it was sort of translated to Chinese in, I think it was 401 of the Common Era. And then it spread throughout East Asia, and it's a sutra that's very popular in many schools of Buddhism, and especially popular within the Zen school. In fact, this book is so old that it predates the Gutenberg Bible by nearly 600 years. So it's a very old book, and there are many commentaries written on it, many, many commentaries. In fact, I think even in the English we have at least 7 or 8 commentaries from different English authors. But like I said, so we're going to really sort of focus on this, what they call a gatha, which I'll explain its meaning shortly. Now, these are at least 3 of the books that I sort of relied upon to help me present the material. The major book is the middle one here, the book called Insight into Emptiness. In that particular book, the Gatha with its 9 similes is in it. And that's the material I've put up online for you, the commentary that Geshe Jumpa Tengchong has put forward. I've also read this one here by Mu Song, the Diamond Sutra. So if you're interested in science, Mu Song comes from a scientific background. He's a monk, of course, but at the same time, highly intelligent and knowing a great deal about Western science. So he's sort of showing how what we know from the science perspective sort of meets up with the perspective of the Buddha. And in Path to Enlightenment by Geshe Thupten Lodin, who was once a teacher in Brisbane, just down the road from us actually, there is a section in there where they have a number of different similes also. Now, the similes, that are contained within the Gatha. Sometimes there's like, I think sometimes there's 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. But the one we're going to focus around is like a star, a visual aberration, a lamp, an illusion, a drop of dew, a bubble, a dream, a lightning's flash, a thundercloud. This is the way one should see the condition. So these are the 9 similes within that gatha. Now, what you find is that when you go through these different translations, like I said, sometimes it's not nine, sometimes it's 10, sometimes it's six, five, eight, and so forth. Not only that, but they're written differently. So like if you look at the first line, like it's a star, a visual aberration, a lamp. You might, sometimes it says a shooting star, a visual aberration, the flame of a lamp. Sometimes it will say a star at dawn. So they're written differently. So I like it short because it's very easy to remember. But then once I've got it memorized, then I'd like to sort of expand it a bit. Because if you just say, you know, a star, for instance, you know, and you look at what appears to your mind immediately. So for me, when I say star, it's just like a star at night. You know, up in the dark sky, you look up, there's all these stars, and you see a star like that. But actually, when you see a shooting star, that's quite different, isn't it? And if you say a star at dawn, that's even more different. And it's really the commentary is really about like a star at dawn or a shooting star, and not just the star in the night sky. And it's the same for the other things. So when they say a flash of lightning in the dark, thunder in a summer cloud. So if you can sort of memorize it shortly and then expand on it after reading the commentary and so forth, you'll find that if you expand it a little bit more, the meaning becomes clearer to you. Now, but today, like I said, I'm going to give you like a brief explanation of the material. We'll look at these nine similes, and I'll show you the three categories that they're in. It's very useful to memorize the nine similes and the three categories. So this is, it's quite simple actually. And we'll have a look at that today. And then we're going to focus in on the simile of the drop of dew. Now, over this 3 weeks that are coming, you know, like today we'll do the drop of dew, and next week we'll do one simile and then we'll do another one. So I can only do these three, one simile a week, and two of the similes, like the drop of dew and a star at dawn, those two have like, they're actually like physical phenomena that you can actually see with your eyes. So I want to do two that you can actually get it with your physical senses, and the last one will be like a dream. Right? And that really shows you like what's going on inside your mind. Like I said, today we'll look at the drop of dew. These similes are all sort of in the 32nd section of the text. And these similes all contain what's called a gatha. It's spelled G-A-T-H-A. Now a gatha is a Sanskrit term for what we call a song or a verse. And it refers especially to any sort of poetic meter, and which is used in legends and so forth. And it's peculiar to either Sanskrit or to another language called Prakrit. So this term gatha, it means to speak, sing, recite, or extol. So in other words, it's a verse sort of recited, usually mentally, in rhythm with the breath as part of a mindfulness practice. And this can be done either in daily life or as part of a meditation or meditative study.
Eddie, is it kind of similar to how we're more familiar with haikus and how there's, you know, a meter within that, and how No,
No,
it's
no,
not.
no, no. It's very similar to like, yeah, actually this little gatha is very similar to the mantra in the Heart Sutra, you know, to tie to Om Gati Gati Paragati Parasangati Bodhisoha. So that's my, everything. And here it's that same sort of thing, like you recite title Om Gati Gati Paragati Parasangati Bodhisoha, Om Gati Gati Paragati Parasangati Bodhisoha. You might do that over and over and over. Here it's a similar type of thing. Where you could say in your mind or under your breath, like a star, a visual aberration, a flame of a lamp, a magician's illusion, a drop of dew, a bubble in a stream, a dream, a flash of lightning in the dark of night, a summer cloud. So you just say these things, and the idea behind it is, so you repeat it over and over and over, and the idea behind it is like I said, they're similes. So they're actually things like stars, the visual aberrations, summer clouds, flashes of lightning. We actually dream. So these are all actualities. And what's going on, so what's going on, and so what we do is we take that simile and then we relate it to what the Buddha teaches in the Stamina Cutta Sutra. So some of you might be familiar with one of the things that, gosh, I can actually see him and the name has just slipped right out of my head. So who is the, one of the great Tibetan saints who ate the nettles and turned green?
Milarepa.
Milarepa, thank you. So, Milarepa had no texts. And he said that his Dharma was the world around him, nature itself. So, we could have no texts, but, we do, stars come out at night, stars vanish in the morning. We can actually see drops of dew on the ground or on grass. We are familiar with clouds. So it's the idea here is to just take, be aware of these natural phenomena and then bring to it our understanding of the Dharma as the Buddha has presented it in the Dhammakaya Sutra. So do you guys have any other questions about this?
I'm sure there are many questions, but we're not going to ask them till you get past today's topics.
Okay, so let's have a look now then at this gatha, right? So in section 32, like I said, which and there's 32 sections that make up the Dhammakaya Sutra. So here it is, the one you're probably familiar with, right? A star, a visual aberration, the flame of a lamp, an illusion, a drop of dew, a bubble, a dream, a lightning's flash, a summer cloud. This is the way one should see the conditioned. So as I've seen in the sutras, the Buddha often gave different types of similes to help the students understand an underlying principle. So the underlying principles here, there are sort of like three major ones in here. But the major ones here are impermanence and emptiness. Because the word is conditioned, right? So all of these things, a star, all that stuff, depends upon causes and conditions. So every cause and condition, when anything comes together through cause and conditions, they are impermanent and they are empty. They are empty because they depend upon their causes and conditions. So these are the two major principles are in here, impermanence and empty of inherent existence. And all these nine similes are applicable to all phenomena, because all phenomena do not exist in the way they appear to us. And none of them can be found when we search for them, just as will be shown later on when we look at each of these similes. So this is true for everything, whether it's yourself, whether it's another, whether it's cyclic existence, whether it's nirvana or enlightenment. So you see, the way that conventional phenomena appear to us, like all these things here, the conventional phenomena, and the way they exist, are in discord. And they're in discord because of the ignorance and latencies that have coloured our minds since beginningless time. And like I'm trying to, the meaning of these similes is potent. So one time, many years ago, where did I go? So I've been studying Buddhism, of course, and I went somewhere down, I think, New South Wales. There was some sort of concert on, but we ended up going on a walk somewhere, and we ended up going through this sewage plant. And in the sewage plant, they have all these like big sewage ponds. Yeah? And what I looked, so I looked at the ponds, and what I could see was the reflection of the moon in each pond. Right? And then that was it. Wow, that's just like that story in the Buddhist teachings, yeah? About how one thing can appear in many things. Like we have one moon, but it's appearing in all these different ponds. And not only that, the moon looks as if it's in the pond. Right? So that made me think immediately of the Buddha nature, and you know, the one Buddha, but the nature of the Buddha is in every sentient being. Yet you can't find it within the sentient being, just like you can't find the moon that's in the water. And so that just came about because, you know, like I remembered something and it all just came back to me seeing it and go, wow, it's just like that. That simile or that metaphor, it's like that. So, you know, the same sort of thing will easily happen to you if you become familiar with some of these similes and then like incorporate it into your everyday life. It's as if, you know, like I said, because we can observe any of these in our daily life, they can spark the memory of the meaning of these similes to arise in our minds, you know, when we're not in formal meditation. And as you all know, you know, we are out there in the world more often than we are in formal meditation. So it's a fantastic way of reminding yourself of impermanence, for instance, or the lack of inherent existence, emptiness. So now what we're going to do now is in the next slide, we're going to look at these nine similes again, but this time we're going to categorize them. And I found this very useful myself, and I think you will too, if you could just, you know, maybe over the next 3 weeks, start becoming familiar with the Gatha itself and the nine similes and see how they fit into these different categories. So let's look at those now, the nine similes. So here's the first category, empty and dependent. The second category describes how we enter into dukkha. How we all produce phenomena like are impermanent, and these phenomena, when they're pervaded by dukkha, are not satisfactory. And finally, there's the category of empty of inherent existence. So these nine similes fit into these three categories, three similes for each category. So this is where it gets easy, right? So the first category, empty and dependent, we have three similes of a star, a visual aberration, and the flame of a lamp. So it's just that first line. So the commentaries focused on that aspect. These phenomena are empty, and whatever is empty exists dependently. So we can see how a star is dependent upon the cause and conditions, its parts, its labeling, and so forth. And as it is dependent upon that, it is empty of inherent nature. And this goes for a visual aberration and the flame of a lamp. Now the next three similes are, of course, on the second line, and they are an illusion, which shows us how we're drawn into dukkha. So there the commentaries are really focused around the 12 links. The dewdrop, which is the one we're talking about today, how things are impermanent and unstable. Now, and finally, a bubble. So feelings are unsatisfactory. Now, of course, in here too, they're all empty and dependent, but the focus is more upon one of these things here. The first one will be dukkha, the second is impermanence and instability, and the last is the unsatisfactory nature of samsaric feelings. And the last, of course, are a dream, a flash of lightning, and a summer cloud. So there the focus is more on just the empty nature of each of these phenomena. And they lack the inherent existence they seem to have. They are empty of inherent existence.
So, Eddie, does that mean that the first column is like the dependent arising ones, and the last column is the ultimate view?
No, the first one is empty and dependent.
Okay.
So all of these are empty and dependent, and that's how it's sort of presented in the commentaries. These ones here, they're all empty and dependent, but the focus here is now on the first one, sort of the nature of how we're drawn into cyclic existence, and how, because it's cyclic existence is dependent upon those 12 links, it's empty. And then the dewdrop, because it depends upon causes and conditions, it is empty of inherent existence and also impermanent. And the bubble, of course, the bubble also depends upon causes and conditions, so therefore it's also empty. And it shows that that way feelings depend upon causes and conditions, but feelings pervaded by grasping at true existence and karma are unsatisfactory in nature. And the last three, the focus is just on the empty nature of each of these phenomena, a dream, a flash of lightning, and a summer cloud. Now, in this last one, empty of inherent existence, is another, aspect that's not sort of obvious, but it's very interesting. What it's pointing out here is the emptiness of the past, present, and the future. So the past is related to the dream, the present, a flash of lightning, and the future, a summer cloud. So the three times are empty of inherent existence. Quite amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, but I don't quite get how. You'll have to spell it out for me.
Yeah. Well, like I said, we can't do the whole lot, so we're just going to do three, and that's why I've taken one from each place, you know? Uh-huh. One to go. So we'll do, I think it's the star is the last, maybe the last one or next week. Then we'll do one, we do a dewdrop, a star, and a dream. So we do something from the empty and dependent category, something from the middle category of dukkha, impermanent and unsatisfactory, and the last one from empty of inherent existence. Maybe I should just say a few words about the ones that we aren't going to do, just to give you some sort of insight into them. So like I said, these three, a star, a visual aberration, and the flame of a lamp, these three are illustrating that conditioned things like these, a star, a visual aberration, and the flame of a lamp, dependently arise. And as they dependently arise, or because they dependently arise, they are empty of inherent existence.
So, Eddie, there is a because in there.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Anything that depends upon something else, we could say that all phenomena that are empty of inherent existence are empty of inherent existence because they depend upon something for their existence. Now, I said, like the simile of the illusion, while also illustrating emptiness and dependent arising, specifically indicates the way in which we are drawn into dukkha by believing false appearances to be true. The simile of the dewdrop illustrates impermanence and instability of the conditioned things of cyclic existence. And the third one, feelings are happy, painful, and neutral, are as transient and unstable as water bubbles. No sooner do they appear than they vanish. The last side, empty of inherent existence, like I said, they just illustrate the emptiness of inherent existence. So a dream is the simile for things being false and not existing as they appear. Yet when we have a dream, like I had a bad dream this morning, I thought it was actually real, it was truly happening to me. And so I woke up and I got up. Yeah, so yeah, it didn't appear to me to be a dream, I thought it was real and it was disturbing and, you know, I got up. But of course, as soon as I did, as soon as my eyes opened, the dream had vanished. So sleep is the condition that brought about the mistaken appearance of it being true within the dream. And like I said, just as soon as I woke up, everything that I dreamt about had disappeared. And so that way the dream is related to the past. The simile of the dream illustrates that phenomena of the past do not inherently exist. And the flash of lightning illustrates the phenomena of the present are not inherently established. And lastly, the summer cloud is connected to the phenomena of the future and also illustrates their lack of existence from their own side. So I think what we need to remember here is, and as these similes are showing us, is whatever is empty of inherent existence exists dependently. And whatever exists dependently is empty of inherent existence. This is what we've got to get our head around. And so when I'm talking like this, you know, we're really sort of talking about how a phenomenon, like a star, for instance, the relationship of the two truths to one phenomena. So the one phenomena here is the star. The two truths are the conventional truth and the ultimate truth. And that star, like, contains both truths. So the star is the conventional truth. The emptiness of that star is the ultimate truth of the star. And it's the same with any of these phenomena. Like if you say, if you go outside and you just look up at the sky, you go, the sky is a conventional phenomena. Therefore, the sky is empty of inherent existence. So I've just told you the two truths about the sky. If you see a person walking down the road, the person is the conventional truth. The person being empty of inherent existence is the ultimate truth of the person. Yeah, this came up a lot in the Heart Sutra, didn't it? It says form is not other than emptiness. Emptiness is not other than form. So we could say a star is not other than emptiness. The emptiness of the star is not other than the star. Have I lost you guys out there? Is it too much?
Well, Anna said, I can see why you are breaking it down into these bite-sized sections because it's a lot to understand. But these similes are just amazing, like the description of the dream, even just being a simile for when you become enlightened, then all of the, you know, the negativities dissolve into emptiness, like when you wake up and the dream disappears. That's pretty amazing. So, they're not difficult similes. It's just kind of trying to be relaxed and open enough to let it soak in.
Yeah. So, like I said, the three we're covering are a star, a dewdrop, and a dream. And, you know, I've put the commentary up where you guys can grab it off the site where Miffy's put it. And you can, and I'm just asking, you know, you can read the whole lot if you like, but each week just go through the commentary and try and over time, you know, assimilate it, because they are amazing. In fact, like I was saying before, how there's lots of similes in the text, because the Buddha found it's a very good way of teaching. In fact, I remember one time Kinsa Rinpoche said, look, whenever you teach about emptiness, you must use examples. You know, examples, stories, similes. It's so much easier to get your head around it rather than just talking emptiness, and dependent arising and so forth. Is, you know, use something else. So today we're going to have a look at the dewdrop. So here we're looking at focus being more on the impermanent nature of phenomena and how these phenomena are unstable. So, you know, remember, of course, as well as being dukkha, impermanent, and unsatisfactory, they're also empty and dependent. So it's just that the emphasis is more on the impermanent aspect of it, or the more on the unstable nature of the phenomena, which in this case is a dewdrop. So as I was saying before, you know, like sometimes they, like most common, it's a dewdrop, but I've also read they talk about it, what do they call it? It's like a hoar frost. So when I was growing up in New Zealand, I grew up in a small town called Tokoroa, and it was cold. Man, it was freezing cold there in winter. And every morning you'd wake up, everything is just covered in frost. So you'd have to walk to school, really cold and so forth. But then come about, I don't know, 11 o'clock, you walk out, it's all gone. So once again, you know, you could use it for a frost that has settled, you know, from the night and the cold and so forth on all the grass, or else you could take just one drop of dew that is on a leaf. So, you know, in the early morning, you can see dew drops on the tips of the blades of grass. And they sort of like twinkle in the sunlight and look, well, quite beautiful. But incredibly unstable. Because once the sun rises and the light, the warmth of the light shines on it, then the dew drops vanish. So this simile is illustrating that conditioned things do not endure for long. In fact, they come into existence and sort of perish in the same moment. Now we take a dewdrop like this and then you go, okay, so the idea is to take something like this, you look around and go, oh my God, the whole world is like this. It's coming in and going out of existence. There's nothing stable about it, it perishes. Same thing's happening to us. Same thing's happening to every object of your senses.
And Eddie, not just the whole world around us, it's happening to the whole world around us, but in a dewdrop, the whole world is actually reflected in a dewdrop, just like, you know, the whole world is reflected in us, our experience.
Yeah, that's right. So we can, you know, so I see the outer world, but also the inner world. So you can say it happened to my body, but also the mind. These phenomena appear, and then they vanish. And this is happening because, like, they depend upon causes and conditions. These phenomena are conditioned by causes and conditions. So I'll give you a couple of other examples. So let's say we cook a meal. So while you're making it and when it's made, it's changing. The whole process is a process of change, isn't it? Until finally we have this thing called a meal, and then it vanishes because we eat it. Or we throw it out, then we give it another name, and it's called rubbish. Or a little bit later becomes compost or something. You know? And so we call that, you know, coarse impermanence. So coarse impermanence is really the changes that take place that are very obvious to your senses. So you can have a meal on a plate, you know, 15 minutes later, it's gone. You know, well, how did it go? He said, well, I ate it. Or someone took it to the kitchen and threw it away. So that's the coarse impermanence of the meal. But the phenomena itself, the thing that we call meal, is changing itself. We can't see that with our senses, but we know it is, because if we just left it there and went back and have a look at it in a year, it'd be like something not looking like a meal anymore. And that is a subtle change. So that's called subtle impermanence. So it's the arising and vanishing of things at each moment, never remaining still for an instant. So subtle impermanence is something we're usually oblivious to. It's not apparent to our senses. However, there's this place in America that the FBI use. I don't know if it's called the murder farm or the, it's got a name. What they do is they take people who've died and they put the corpse out there, and then they put cameras on it and they record the decomposition of the corpse.
Yeah, it's some kind of the forensics facility.
Yeah, that's right. And so, over time, that corpse disintegrates. And what's quite interesting, I've seen pictures of where there's a body there, and then there's just like a sort of a damp patch on the ground, like something was there, because the ground is different coloured. But it's like the whole body just sort of vanishes, and it goes over time. So different phenomena disintegrate at different rates. But there's nothing stable about any produced or conditioned phenomena. In fact, I think for ourselves, even all the organs we have inside us change at different rates, don't they? It's not just we have a body, a thing called a body, here's my body, and it disintegrates all at once at the same time.
Yeah, the organs age actually at different rates. So we are multiple ages at the same time.
Yeah, exactly right. And then over, I think it's 7 or 8 years, and everything that was, we once called us, is completely new. And yet we still call it us, but it's not the same. They're not the same lungs, they're not the same kidneys, they're not, there's a whole massive change gone through. And we're not doing it. It does it because it's produced independent upon causes and conditions. So for all conditioned phenomena, we don't have to do anything to bring about the change. It's their nature to not remain in the next instant. In fact, the Buddha taught that all conditioned things, like a dewdrop, like a person, like a star, all conditioned things have the aspect of non-existence, in that they do not exist as something that will endure, because they do not endure, they are not reliable or secure. And, even just looking at this dewdrop now, I'm just sort of thinking, wow, as I was talking to you, I thought, it's the same with our feelings. Feelings are conditioned, but they're not reliable. You just look at how much people fall in love every day, and then 7 years later they're divorced, their feelings changed. And so we can't rely upon our feelings to tell us the truth about something. They're not reliable and they're not secure. In fact, the Buddha says, for this reason, because they're not reliable, they're not secure, we should not count on the things and people of cyclic existence to remain the same. The people and things of cyclic existence are constantly in flux, constantly changing, arising and ceasing, disintegrating from one moment to the next. So I don't know whether you've done this, but I remember doing this. As a kid, was looking out in the morning and going out, and you could see dew on the leaves. And you watch, and then it's not like that anymore. It becomes like a little rivulet. And then a little bit later, even that's gone. And that's just because the sun is getting up, isn't it? The light and the heat hit that drop of dew, and it vanishes. So just as like Miffy pointed out before, you see a world in a grain of sand, or a world reflected in a dewdrop. Even if we look out at stars, those stars of what we're seeing is the light of something that's gone out. So at some stage, somewhere in the universe, what was called a planet or a star has actually ceased. But in its destructiveness, its light has just traveled through space and we see the light. And you think, oh, there's a star. But right, it's not there. Just something that went out. And we're just sort of looking at the gone out.
See, that one, Eddie, it's just brilliant because it's so obvious, and yet I don't think of it when I look at stars.
No, I know there's a lot. The ordinary phenomena of our world, once you sort of investigate, even from the science or the natural science aspect, you can, and you take that part and then you move it to what the Buddha taught, there's a meeting there. You know, and you can see, my gosh, what the Buddha taught about these phenomena is true. And, you know, here's an example of it. So that's enough. So today, I've given you the shortest explanation and focused it around the dewdrop. Because I thought if I did the other ones, we'd run out of time, because the dream and the star are quite, there's a lot of things you can say about a dream and the star. But here, like I said, it's quite straightforward. We see that the dewdrop, being dependent upon causes and conditions, is unstable and impermanent. Being dependent upon other factors, it is empty of inherent existence. In fact, if the dewdrop was not empty of inherent existence, it could either not arise or it would never cease. And neither of those two things take place, right? So therefore it's empty of inherent existence. It's a conventional truth phenomenon. So we can say the conventional truth about this dewdrop is that it is produced, dependent upon causes and conditions. Therefore it's impermanent, it is unstable. Now, whatever you had to describe this thing about the dewdrop, that would all be on the side of conventional truth. So the ultimate truth of it, from the middle way consequence perspective, is always it is empty of inherent nature. Because it's dependent, it is empty of inherent existence. So we're going to come up to the next slide now, and here we're just going to talk about some of the benefits that can arise through studying all nine similes, but in this case we're going to look at these three, and today this one. The first one is you could realize the great kindness of Buddha. So what does this mean, this little statement here in relationship to the simile of the dewdrop? Well, one of the major causes of our suffering is to grasp at impermanent phenomena to be permanent, to grasp at unstable phenomena to be stable. To grasp at phenomena will perish naturally, in fact is perishing from moment to moment, as if it were imperishable. It was never going to do that. So every time we make these three mistakes of grasping at the impermanent to be permanent and so forth, we're making a mistake, and doing that will cause us suffering. Not so much in terms of like dewdrops and so forth, but in terms of people in particular, or feelings or thoughts. Because people and thoughts are just like that dewdrop. Impermanent, unstable, changing moment to moment. So it's like taking these things from the natural world and then relating them back to ourselves. Because that's the point of these similes. If we could do that, you know, remember the similes, we wouldn't be perpetuating our own suffering. It's a way of putting an end to that perpetuation of suffering for ourselves. So, you know, relationships fall apart. The people we care about die. The things that we, the phenomena that we hold on to and call dear, they will break or fall apart or get lost or be harmed in some way. And that's just because these phenomena aren't under their own power. They are under the power of causes and conditions. So if we could just, you know, understand that, then that would have that could help us let go of the grasping at the impermanent to be permanent, you know, the unstable to be stable. So this is a great kindness because it's sort of showing us, look, if you grasp at phenomena to be what they're not, you're going to suffer. And the suffering is like self-perpetuated. We're doing it to ourselves. It's not in, nothing else is doing it to us. We're doing it to ourselves. The grasping is doing it. The belief in falsities that's doing it. As I said, I thought, well, it's also interesting that the belief in a falsity is also conditioned. So it can vanish too. It's like the good and the bad can vanish. So this one here is a little bit has to do with the we can relate it to the dewdrop. But here it's more on the empty nature of the dewdrop. Because emptiness is the foundation for everything. Everything that does exist is empty. And because it's empty, things that exist do so either depend upon their cause or conditions or their parts. And of course, even more subtly on a consciousness and a the labeling process. So if we keep grasping at the phenomena to be permanent and to have self where there is no self, meaning grasping to be permanent and then grasping to be inherently existent when there is no inherent nature there, we will bring about suffering for ourselves, in other words, relating to the phenomena mistakenly. And the way to bring about an end to our own suffering is we've got to relate to the truth as the truth. So the truth being, we are not permanent. We lack a self. These are two fantastic things that we could know through our own inquiry and through our own experience. So this is does not require faith or like belief. You can actually know this. And how do we come to know it? Through making an inquiry. Through inquiring, you know, like if I were permanent, that would mean I was not subject to change. I would not change. Is that true about me? Go, no, absolutely not. So phenomena, conditioned phenomena, are impermanent. Now, if I thought there, you know, that I actually existed in the way that I appeared to myself, which is to have an inherent nature, Then we go, okay, that's what it looks like. If I do inherently exist, these would be the consequences. We find that goes out the window too. That's impossible. So we can know intellectually, even before actually getting a direct insight into it, our own gross and subtle impermanence and our own empty nature. Through our own reasoning. And the reasoning coming out of inquiry. So like I said, it's not that we have to believe it because the Buddha says it or because Geshe-la said it or anyone else says it or a book says it. They do say this, but don't leave it there. Like, check it out. Inquire yourself, and then you will be convinced that this is true. And of course, when you are convinced, then you will definitely act in accordance with the Buddha's teaching on karmic cause and effect. Now, of course, there are many, many other benefits of studying the sutra and the gatha itself. In fact, the Buddha said at one stage that anyone who repeats the sutra or the gatha, even just four lines of the text, and that's why they've got the four lines of the gatha, just four lines of the text, the merit is just immeasurable. In fact, he says it's better than giving an entire world system filled with gifts. It's better to memorize one of four lines of this text. In fact, Lama Zopa has a little bit of commentary about this up online, and he says, so this is taken from what he says. Buddha said to Rabdul, the benefits of the Diamond Sutra are as follows. Listening to the Diamond Sutra generates merit far greater than the merit gained from making charity of the body, meaning giving away your body, as many times as there are grains of sand in the river Ganges, for 10,000 trillion eons, a long, 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 long time. One generates a vast amount of merit. Therefore, there's no need to say how much merit is gained by anybody who writes it, receives it, memorizes it, keeps it, reads it, tries to understand its meaning, and even hears us four lines of it. And then, even somebody who purely reveals it to others. This is Rabdul. The merit gained through this Dharma is inconceivable. Just keeping the text generates so much merit. And of course, there's even more by revealing it to others. And Lama Zopa says, look, so listen to the teachings and don't give up. What he means here is don't give up trying to understand the meaning of this. Then he says, look, Rabdul, those sentient beings who have committed non-virtuous actions, which cause them to be reborn in the lower realms, will experience those karmas in this life, by depending upon the sutra. The non-virtuous actions of past lives, which cause us to be reborn in the evil realms, are completely purified, and they will achieve enlightenment. Actually, I remember there's a Geshe Michael Roach. So he worked in the diamond industry, and he was a great, a teacher of this text. He was going all over the world teaching the Diamond Cutter Sutra. And I could see why, like if you sort of read the material about the benefits and so forth, then so get some sort of inkling into what's being said. You could be sort of feel very empowered, like you'd really want to go out and teach the meaning of this text to others. So what we have for you now is Lama Zopa Rinpoche reciting the Gatha. So it gives you all now a chance to listen to him speak and say it. And you're like, he's the founder, one of the founders, the living founder of this organization called the FPMT. He's the root guru of many of us and can be seen as a great bodhisattva in this life, or even as an enlightened, awakened being, a Buddha himself. So let's have a listen with you to what Lama Zopa are reciting.
Yeah. So just because I'm not sure how this works, can you just stop your screen share? And I will put up the screen share for on the YouTube clip. So this the way that Rinpoche recites this verse is really quite slow and quite amazing. It's a way of meditating on it, but also, of course, the way that Rinpoche recites it is in all of its profundity, but also in a very relaxed way. He will interject and say a little thing here and there as well. So I will.
So eyes and especially
Okay, so there you hear Lama Zopa going through the similes in Tibetan and pausing and reflecting upon the meaning of each of them. And which brings us basically to the end of our class. So look, we had an overview of this four-line gatha. Remember, we had the three categories, the first category being empty and dependent. And it was, you know, the star, a visual aberration, and flame the lamp. Then we had the next three similes. And there we showed how we're drawn into dukkha, impermanence. And the unsatisfactory nature of feelings within cyclic existence. In the last three, of course, really related to the emptiness of the past, present, and future. We looked particularly today at the simile of the dewdrop, which is really sort of focused upon the aspect of the impermanent, insubstantial, and nature of the anything produced, anything that's conditioned. We also looked at the benefits of some of the study. So what I'd like you to do is to read the commentary on this, the material on pages 1 and 2. And do you I'd really love you to sort of memorize these 9 similes. We've got 3 weeks, you could use just the first top three in the week if you like. But try and get them all. Like I said, it makes a real good difference when your mind sort of becomes familiar with Dharma, then it starts seeing it everywhere in the things around you. And it can remind you of compassion, it can remind you of the mind of enlightenment, it can remind you of emptiness, dependent arising, and the nature of cyclic existence. So it's very useful, these similes. And next week we're going to look at the simile of the star. So, if you want to, there's material about that simile up there. You might like to have a read of that just to prepare yourself for next week. Are there any final questions that you guys would like to ask before we close up and I dedicate?
Everyone's been very quiet today, Eddie. So there aren't any questions yet. Yes, I mean, it's clear, but it just seems like just talking about this kind of topic, you have to have your mind quite kind of relaxed and open and refined, and it's quite a delicate balance to be able to have everything kind of absorb in the right way.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, one of the texts I read about this, the commentary on this, the author actually said to approach with an open and relaxed mind.
Right.
Yeah.
So Anne has a question about the title of a book by His Holiness. Not sure what the question is. Has His Holiness written a commentary on this, Eddie? Do you know?
No, but I'll tell you what, there's which I've been listening to for this class, there is a commentary by His Holiness the Dalai Lama on the Diamond Cutter Sutra. It's got part one and part two on YouTube.
Okay.
Great, but it's very clear. It's got a very good translator this time.
Mm-hmm.
So I listen to that. I put it on, I speed it up a little, so it's on, one and a half times, that's enough, rather than double time, just one and a half. And it's easy to understand. So give that a go, because I certainly have been, and I'll do it again during the week.
The question from Anne there is that a book called A Flash of Lightning in the Dark of Night. Yeah. So does that relate to this simile in the Vajrakatha? It's the guide to the Bodhisattva's way of life.
That simile there is used in a different way. Actually, it's not so much about the it's related to virtue. And how virtue is very, very brief and rarely appears. So they've used the simile, but they've used lightning, but it's used in a different way to explain something else rather than the empty nature.
Great, very helpful, thank you.
Okay, so now folks, I want to dedicate for all of you.
So just stop the screen share to dedicate.
Okay, I dedicate for all of you and for myself and every other living being. And I dedicate just like those great bodhisattvas, Samanta Bhadra Manjushri did. So I dedicate these merits created by ourselves, the Buddha's bodhisattvas and sentient beings, so like a dream or an illusion, but exist in mere name. May we attain mere enlightenment and lead all the dreamlike sentient beings who exist in mere name to that enlightenment which exists in name only, by ourselves alone, who, like dreams or illusions, exist in mere name. Okay. Thank you very, very much for being here, making my life meaningful. Look at that. We're listening to the Dharmakaya Sutra. I'm telling you about it. It's all come through the kindness of others. So thank you very, very much for being here, and I hope to see you again shortly.